Today we begin our fourth study of 1 John chapter 2 verses 15 through 17, and I want to read the scripture to you again so that you can keep the context in mind. 1 John chapter 2 verse 15, "Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God lives forever." Let's bow together in prayer. Father God, we come to you wanting to hear from you today, wanting you to speak to us, wanting you to make the scriptures plain, wanting you to show us how to apply these truths specifically to our own lives as individuals and as a church. And so, Father, by the living word and by the power of your Spirit, speak clearly today. This is my prayer in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. As we've done the last two times, I want to make just a quick review, reminding you that loving the world represents believing I have the right of self-determination. That is, it's believing that I can choose to go my own way, to rule my own life, to decide for myself what is right and what is wrong, what I will do and what I won't do, rather than submitting to God rule. And I choose self-rule because I want to do as I please, when I please, for as long as I please. It's a self-interested, a self-centered motivation, which makes perfect sense that loving the world is in essence loving self-rule or self-determination. And those who live by the mindset or value system of the world believe they not only have the power of self-determination, that is the free will, but they believe they have the right, the position, the authority to rule themselves. On the other side of that, loving God and His kingdom represent believing that only God holds the position and has the authority to determine what I can and cannot do. In other words, loving God is choosing God rule over self-rule so that I no longer live for myself, but now I live for God and His glory. I submit to God and do His will. You remember the statement of Christ in the prayer that He taught His disciples, "Thy will, O God, be done on earth as it is in heaven." And that is my longing when I live by God rule. Choosing God rule is believing that, yes, we have the power of self-determination. We believe everyone does, but we no longer have the right of self-determination. And we never had that right, by the way. Even those who rebel against God do not have that right. They will be punished for their rebellion. But we realize it is not our right, and so we live in submission to the will and rule of God. And the last thing I want to say about that is willing submission to the rule and will of God is equal to, let me say those two words again, equal to, it's equal to loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Never allow obedience and love to be separated in your relationship to God. Never allow that to happen. Because if you do, it won't be long before you believe that you can love God and the world at the same time. And that's just impossible. Finally, last week I gave you four examples to help us see why it is impossible to love the world and love God at the same time. And I would just remind you of this one truth. The world and God have conflicting and contradictory interests and demands. And that ought to be sufficient to convince us that we cannot serve them both, love them both, cling to them both, belong to them both at the same time. Now today I want to give you definitions for the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, so that we can see why loving them stands in the way of loving God just as much as loving the world stands in the way of loving God. 1 John 2:16, once more, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world." This first category, lust of the flesh, might easily bring to mind the objects of fleshly desires. And we could spend the rest of the time identifying these objects and making a list of them and then going out and trying to avoid these objects the rest of our life. But that's not the purpose of this phrase. This phrase refers to an established and firmly held belief system that drives the lusts of our flesh. And the essence of this lust-driving belief system is a conviction that there are things in this world that will do and can do more for us than God in His ways will or can do. In other words, the lust of the flesh is built on the belief that the world offers us things. Things like experiences, things like pleasures, things like earthly security, things like fame, things like fortune, things like possessions, things like entertainment, things that numb the pain, things that make us feel better, that are feel goods, as we call them in our age today. The world offers us these things, and there's many of them, and we believe that some of these things can do more for us than God will do or can do for us. And so when push comes to shove, when we feel the need, whether it's the need for affirmation, approval, acceptance, whether it's the need for more money, whether it's the need for some pleasure that we feel we're missing out on, whether it's the need for some possession that somebody else has that we want, whether it's the need for some experience that thrills or excites us, whatever it is, when we have that need and we feel that God is not meeting that need, what we do is we turn to go the fleshly way and we satisfy these fleshly lusts in ways that satisfy our lusts. And to do that, we must pull ourselves out from under God rule, move over to self rule, and pursue the lusts of the flesh as we see fit, according to our own desires, according to our own self-determination. Now let me clarify what I'm trying to say here. The lust of the flesh is a belief system. It's a conviction that there are things in this world that will do for me and can do for me more than God will or can do. And the lust of the flesh derives its motivation from the belief that the world offers the things that I need to satisfy myself, to gratify my lusts, to bring to me the kind of pleasure or happiness or security or wealth or whatever it is I'm looking for, to bring to me those things in the way I want them. Now, the power of the lust of the flesh comes, in my opinion, from two sources. And the first source is our selfish longings for pleasure, for excitement, for happiness, for diversion from pain, for security, for possession, and for riches. We human beings are generally discontent. We long for more. We want more than we have. And so we have these desires, and these desires easily turn into lusts. And lusts are nothing more than desires that have moved outside the boundaries that God has given us for sane, sensible, Christian, godly living. And these lusts are the power behind the lusts of the flesh that come from inside me. James affirms this truth in James chapter 1, and I want to start reading at verse 13. Here's what James says about this. "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one of us is tempted when we are carried away and enticed by our own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin." In other words, when we think about it and we begin to follow that lust into the direction that it's wanting to take us, it leads to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. In other words, we have lust welling up within us. We have desires welling up within us, desires for things that we ought not to desire as children of God. And yet we desire them, and they well up within us, and they cry out for fulfillment, and that's one of the powers behind the lust of the flesh. The other major source of power for the lust of the flesh, in my opinion, comes from the inability of the world to satisfy our lusts. Worldly things do not satisfy us long term. True, they bring momentary gratification, but they cannot bring a true inner contentment. And so we're driven to seek worldly gratification over and over and over again. A lust rises up within us. We go out from under God's rule, and we go our own way to satisfy it. And sure, it's gratified. We feel happy for the moment. We feel satisfied for the moment. But as you all know, and I know only too well, that satisfaction is short-lived. It is not permanent. It does not satisfy us until we die. It only satisfies us for the moment. Maybe a day, maybe a week, but in time the satisfaction is gone and we need more satisfaction. And so the second power behind the lust of the flesh is the inability of worldly things to satisfy us long-term. Oh, we're satisfied momentarily, but then we have to go back and get satisfaction again. We have to seek what the world offers for gratification over and over and over again. And this is the reason that the lusts of the flesh repeatedly weigh on our mind. Oh, you can think about something today, go off and gratify it, and yes, it's gone from your mind, but it'll come back tomorrow. It'll come back again, and it'll stay there on your mind until you gratify it or until you throw it out and have nothing to do with it. It's like a child that's been spoiled wanting his way. He stays right there with the parent, demanding and crying and hollering and throwing tantrums and doing whatever the child has to do to get his way with the parent. And the lusts of our flesh are just like that. They well up within us and they cry out and they cry out and they cry out for fulfillment. And we may satisfy them, but the satisfaction from the world is temporary. And so the lusts of the flesh not only repeatedly weigh on our mind, but they stimulate our feelings. They get our feelings going. We can feel the need for that. We can feel what we're missing out on. We can feel the pain of not being satisfied or gratified with the approval or the acceptance or the fame or the riches or whatever it is we seek. We can feel it. The lust of the flesh stimulates our feelings and it energizes our emotions. And surely we all can see that the lust of the flesh encourages our passions. And all of these things drive us to seek gratification again after having just sought it moments ago or hours ago or several days ago or even weeks ago. Why? Because the world is unable to satisfy us long term. Now, why is the lust of the flesh tied to loving the world when gratifying the lust of the flesh feels so good? Why shouldn't that be something good? Why shouldn't that be something godly? Well, the reason the lust of the flesh is tied to loving the world is that the gratification of our fleshly lust requires pulling away from submission and obedience to the rule and will of God in order to go our own way, in order to seek and obtain the gratification we seek. You see, our fleshly lust desires things that are outside God's boundaries. And in the pursuit of those things, we must turn away from submission to the will and rule of God and begin to exercise self-rule as if it were our right. And so, the lust of the flesh is directly tied to loving the world. I realize I haven't given you many examples of this, but I suspect we can think of our own examples quite easily if we'll apply our minds to such thinking. And I want to encourage you to consider that it isn't just the actual physical gratification that takes us out from under God rule and puts us into self rule. It can also be fantasy. It can also be just entertaining ideas and thoughts and pictures in our mind. These things take us out from under God rule and put us under self rule just as much as actual physical activities of gratification. Let me ask you just several questions before we move on to the lust of the eye. What fleshly lusts do you treasure and therefore pursue, at least from time to time? What fleshly lusts do you treasure? Think about that. Second question, why haven't you killed off that particular fleshly lust or those fleshly lusts that you know show up on a repeated basis? In other words, why are you still clinging to them? And my third question is, do you see that these fleshly lusts prevent you from loving God as you ought, that is, with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength? Do you see that? Let's move on to the lust of the eye. The lust of the eye, like the lust of the flesh, is built on a belief system, but it's built on two different belief systems, somewhat distinct from each other, and both of which are attractive to us. First of all, the lust of the eye is the belief that some pleasure or happiness is better than doing without. Second, it is the belief that I should be able to possess and enjoy what others possess and enjoy. Now let me talk about those two beliefs. The first belief, again, is some pleasure or happiness is better than none. And it's built around the idea that if I cannot have what I desire, then at least I can get a bit of it, or I can fantasize about it, or dream about it, or pretend to have it, and in so doing, gain at least some of the pleasure or gratification or security or relief that comes from possessing or experiencing the real thing. Now, to help us see what I'm talking about, I'm going to give you two examples, and I think these two examples are the greatest offenders of this belief related to the lust of the eye. The first example has to do with sexual immorality, be it looking and lusting at members of the opposite sex, or pornography, or simply daydreaming or fantasizing about someone other than your spouse, and engaging in acts of self-pleasure. Now, I realize this is a touchy topic and one that we want to discuss carefully, especially in a setting like this. Nevertheless, this makes the point really well from my perspective. You see, even according to Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, the one who looks and lusts would like to commit adultery physically, but they feel constrained for some reason. Whatever that constraint is, maybe it's their Christian beliefs, maybe it's the presence of their wife, maybe they're afraid of getting some sexually transmitted disease. There could be many reasons for a sense of constraint. So they don't commit the act physically. But what do? They don't leave adultery out of their life. They don't throw adultery out and say, okay, adultery is no longer an option for me. They fall back to something less. And something less is evil, but it is not what they prefer. It is just a piece of the pie. It is not the whole pie which they prefer. They prefer the whole pie of actual immorality, sexual immorality, plain old adultery. But they can't have that physical act, so they fall back on daydreaming, on fantasizing, looking at pornography, pleasuring themselves. Well, why do they do that? Because they believe that a piece of the pie is better than no pie at all. They want the whole pie, can't get it, so they'll take a piece of it. Now, I see this in my own life. There have been times when I've wanted to do something, but I knew without question that it was wrong, that I had no business doing that, that it would be a sin against God and a sin against my wife. And so, no, I didn't do what I really wanted to do. But what I did do was get as close to the boundary of right and wrong as I could get without crossing the line. In other words, I wanted something. I knew I couldn't have it all, that I would be in too much trouble if I did, that it was just wrong, and I didn't want to sin against God that way, but I didn't want to give up my lust of the eye either. And so I went for a supposedly acceptable piece of the pie. I didn't commit the outright obvious sin. I just got close enough to the sin to get some of the good feeling that comes from the sin, and I called that acceptable. I treated it as if it was okay for me to do that. And that is the lust of the eye, the belief that some pleasure or some happiness is better than none. My second example concerning this first belief related to the lust of the eye is what I call consumer deprivation. Let me give you those two words again. Consumer deprivation. And consumer deprivation is looking at the world's goods, be it houses, furniture, clothing, cars, boats, and the like, and gaining at least some good feeling by thinking about how good life would be if I possessed what I was looking at. My mother used to call it window shopping. We may call it just looking. Consider all the time we might spend in a mall just looking and thinking about what life would be like if we had some of the clothes or some of the gadgets or some of the things that were there, or going to a car dealership or going to a boat show or a motorcycle show or a fashion show or even a Tupperware party. And I'm not hitting on Tupperware parties, please, but get the idea. The idea is we go and we look, and as we look, we entertain the idea that life would be better if we had those things, and we may even spend some time thinking about that, fantasizing about that, daydreaming about that. How many of us look through circulars that come to our homes? Why are we looking through them? Because they have pictures of things we would enjoy. Can we afford them? Are we really going to go out and buy them? No. Then why are we looking at them? Because they give us a sense of pleasure just considering what life would be like if we had them. How many of us have dreamed about winning the lottery? Oh, if we could just win $10 million or $20 million or just $1 million. Oh, we could do so much with that. And we think about that. Why? Because it brings us a sense of pleasure, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of hope, just entertaining that idea. And that's the belief that some pleasure or some happiness is better than none. Now, when I started this lust of the eye, I said that there's two distinct beliefs related to it. And so I want to move on to that second belief. And the second belief related to the lust of the eye is that I should be able to possess and enjoy what others possess and enjoy. It's based on the idea of greed or envy. In other words, when I look and see what others have, and I realize I desire that, remember Eve, she looked on the tree, and she saw that it was good for food. She desired it just from that standpoint alone. And we look on what others have, and we believe it brings joy to their life, it brings fulfillment to their life, it makes their life somehow better, and we want those things for ourselves, and so we entertain the idea not just as a fantasy, but as a pursuit. And we end up buying things we ought not to buy. We end up spending money we ought not to spend. We end up getting involved in activities we ought not to get involved in. We end up possessing things that we ought not to possess, things that stand in the way of us living a Christ-like life. One of the things I decided many, many years ago, early on in my Christian life, is that I would never own anything that I had to trailer a distance in order to use, or that I had to drive to a distance in order to enjoy. Now, what that means is that I'm not going to own a boat, or I'm not going to own a cottage, or things related to either one of those, because it requires trailering or traveling in order to enjoy them. And that trailering and traveling takes time, and that time takes away from my pursuit of God and my living for God in the world. And for me, that has been something that I have avoided and stayed away from. Why? Because I don't enjoy those things? Don't kid yourself. I could thoroughly enjoy a cottage on a lake with a fireplace for the winter and snowmobiles to go out snowmobiling and dirt bikes for dirt riding and good water for water skiing and swimming and all the fun that goes with it. I could thoroughly enjoy that. I could live there and be thrilled with that privilege. But it works against my soul, and so I say no to that. And as far as trailering things, yes, a boat would be great. I've loved water skiing, but to have to trailer a boat an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to a lake in order to enjoy it, no. That just cuts into the time that I have for God and for others. And so the lust of the eye looks and sees what others have and wants it and gets us involved in things that war against our own soul, against our own walk with God, against our own Christian living. And we need to be on guard against that. David looked on Bathsheba, and look where that took him. Achan, remember Achan? He was the fellow that saw the gold and the clothing in Jericho, and he took it back to his tent and hid it under his tent floor. He wanted it, and look where it got him. James speaks about the lust of the eyes in chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, and he says this, "You lust and do not have, so you commit murder." That's how far we go when we want something. We don't just spend what we ought not to spend. We don't just get involved in things we ought not to get involved in. We go so far as doing really evil things like murder. You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. Well, let me ask just a couple questions here. What do you look at with eyes of lust? What do you look at so that you can have a piece of the pie when you realize you can't have the whole pie? What do you look at that others have that you long for and then pursue when you ought not to pursue those things? What do you look at with eyes of lust? And the second question is, do you see how those eyes of lust stand in the way of your loving God? And if you don't see that, would you consider that? Would you think about that? Would you pray about that? The third phrase here in 1 John chapter 2, verse 16 is the boastful pride of life. And here again, there are two prongs to this pride. First, there is pride over self-accomplishment, over being a self-made person, over making myself a success. And the second side is the pride of wanting the world's approval or seeking the world's opinion so as not to be negatively labeled as different or seen as strange or looked down on. And so we see these two prongs to this pride. The pride of, I've done it. This is me. I'm the one who's accomplished this. Look at me. And the pride of wanting people to approve of us, to accept us, to praise us. Now the pride of accomplishment begins when we are children. We've all seen children who want to do it themselves. Let me do it, Mom. Let me do it, Dad. I want to do that. Can I do that? Now, there's a good side to that because that's how they learn and that's how they grow. And we don't want to just simply say no to that. But I'd like you to see that there's more there than just the desire to do. There's a pride in accomplishment. There's a pride in I did it myself. And that attitude stays with us. And if we do not kill that attitude purposefully, deliberately, it will stay within us. And we may subdue that attitude. We may dress it up and make it look very adult and even Christian, but that attitude can still be there. I know I've said this before, but I want to use this example here. Over these past several years, I've been asking God to show me my pride. And one of the things that has stood out to me is that underlying my service to God, my desire to do the will of God, my willingness to give up so much to serve God as He has asked me to serve Him, is the desire that somehow, someday, somewhere, someone would think that I've got something good to say. Did you hear me? I have something good to say. That's about me, not about God. I have wanted to be seen as someone who thinks and who understands and comprehends and is able to speak it out clearly to others so that they want to hear me. And that's nothing but pride, the boastful pride of life. And I've had to war against that in my own life. And we all can feel that as adults. We can feel that urge to accomplish things ourselves, to be recognized ourselves as having done it. David did this. I did this. No. What does Jesus say? Blessed are the poor in spirit, Matthew 5:3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Those are the ones who heaven is given to. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the humble. Blessed are those who realize that nothing good comes from themselves. Everything they have comes from God. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And then Paul speaks to the church in Corinth about this great truth and this human weakness, which is in all of us. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Paul says these words, "Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God. He's the one who makes the rain fall and the sun shine on righteous and unrighteous alike. He's the one who created bodies that heal themselves in so many ways and get a stronger immune system when they get colds and flus and get better from that. He's the one who allows us to have seasons whereby we know we can plant in the spring and reap in the fall. He's the one that makes all this possible. We're not adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, because our adequacy comes from God. And lest we forget the foolishness of pride, let me remind us all that God sets himself against the proud. He opposes the proud. It is just foolishness to think, I did this, and to take pleasure in that, and to take joy in that, and to have that boastful pride of life and want people to recognize what I have done. That's just foolishness. Why? Because it sets God against me. And I got to say this very clearly to you. I, as an individual, don't need God opposed to me. I've got enough problems in life. But notice, God gives grace to the humble. He takes sides with the humble. He comes alongside and helps the humble. And you can find this in James chapter 4, verse 6, and in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5. Now, the other side of the boastful pride of life is that pride that seeks the approval of man. And we see this weakness in almost everyone, just as we see the weakness we just talked about. Who of us doesn't want the approval and the acceptance of others? Who of us doesn't desire to be thought of as a good person, as a wise person, as a friendly person, as somebody that others want to be around? We all want to be seen that way. And there's a sense to which that's really good. But the problem comes in when our desire for the approval of others stands in the way of our desire for God's approval, so that we make God's approval a lesser issue, a lesser concern, a lesser desire than our desire for the approval of others. You see, when our desire for the approval of others exceeds our desire for God's approval, then we are wanting the things of this world and not the things of God. We are wanting the things that feed our pride, not the things that feed our humility. And we end up getting the things that stand squarely in the way of loving God and helping us love the world rather than the other way around. And we may grow in godliness, sufficient to resist the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eye, yet we may still be prone to move just a bit away from the will of God in order to preserve the world's positive opinion of us. How many of us have been silent when we ought to have spoken clearly the truth of God in a situation? Why? Because we wanted the world's positive opinion of us. How many of us have said less than we ought, or have agreed to things we shouldn't have agreed to, or just nodded along with the crowd? Why? Because we wanted the world's positive opinion of us. How many have done what others wanted us to do, knowing that we really shouldn't do that? It's not for their good, and it's not for our good, and they're simply taking advantage of us. And why would we do it? Because we want the world's positive opinion of us. And how many of us have hid our love for God? That's right, we've hidden it. Why? In order to keep the world's positive opinion of us. Proverbs 29:25 says this. That's Proverbs 29:25. The fear of man brings a snare, but he who trusts in the Lord will be exalted. Well, what's a snare? A snare is something that entangles us so as to trip us up so that we can be captured. The fear of man brings a snare. Well, who wants to entangle us? Not God in regard to this, but the devil, the world. And our flesh foolishly goes along because of what it wants. And what does the devil want to do? He wants to capture us. He wants to get us back on his side. He wants us to support his agenda, to be part of his team. And so he snares us. He entangles us so that we trip up and can be captured. The fear of man brings a snare. But he who trusts in the Lord will be exalted. You want to be exalted? Give up seeking the approval of others. Put your pride to rest. Pick up humility. And let others be praised, and you be exalted by the Lord. Let me ask some questions in closing here. Are you more afraid of the world's displeasure than God's displeasure? Are you? You know, we cannot break free of the love of the world as long as we have in our hearts a liking for the world's approval or a sensitiveness to the world's censure that exceeds our love for God. Do you have some boastful pride of life in you? And if you do, are you willing to throw it out? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life each and all together stir our passions, motivate our thinking, stimulate our feelings, and lead us into situations that require departing from God's will and way in order to gain the gratification we seek. And so, just as loving the world represents a deeply held commitment to self-rule, so pursuing the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, these find fulfillment along the same pathway of self-rule. And we must step off the path of submission to God's rule and will in order to get on that path of self-rule and gratification of our fleshly lusts and our visual lusts and our boastful pride of life. And so, if you think you've made good progress in putting an end to your love for the world and nurturing a sincere love for God, yet you still knowingly protect and willingly enjoy some area of fleshly lust or visual lust or pride, then you're deceiving yourself. And the truth is, if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Let's bow together in prayer.